my name's Doug. I'm an alcoholic. Well, let's see. It all started. I've been coming around Alcoholics Anonymous for a while. I want to. I really appreciate being asked to speak at this meeting. Larry called me actually numerous times, so he's very diligent about making sure the speakers show up and sent me emails as well, making sure I would dress appropriately and all that sort of. Because I do represent Alcoholics Anonymous up here, but I am just one alcoholic talking to another, in this case, a bunch of alcoholics in the room at the same time. So it's been explained to me that what I'm responsible to do here is to share my experience, strength, and hope, what it was like for me, what happened, and what it's like now. So I'll do my best to share that. And I also brought along this book. Some of you may have seen this in the past. And there's a guy right there with a book. All right, so I'm not a person that can remember and quote something and tell you what page it's on, but I can quote. So I thought, you know, it might be wise to maybe earmark a few pages that may be helpful to you in a keeping your sobriety if you have it, and attaining sobriety if you are at that stage. You know, I'm not a doctor, I'm not a psychologist, a psychiatrist, I'm not an expert on Alcoholics Anonymous or on alcoholism. I simply share my experience, strength, and hope. The sobriety that I have currently came about by me meeting this guy at a 6:45 a.m. meeting in Ocean Beach, which still exists 6 days a week, called Harmony Group. His name was Tom Parkinson, the average alcoholic. That's how he referred to himself. He died with 22 years sober, and he told me there's three things I should know, and that's what my sobriety date is, and that is March 25th of 1995. What my home group is, currently that's Ocean Beach Tuesday night, of which I just finished doing a year commitment as a secretary. And thirdly, that I should have a sponsor and know who it is and get active with that sponsor and with that home group in order to maintain the sobriety. And so I've tried to have a commitment pretty much for my entire sobriety. Sometimes I have more than one. I may have one at one meeting and one. Actually, I like to have a commitment in each meeting. I'm not always able to do that. But I told Tom, you know, yeah, I can, you know, that sounds reasonable. And he said, now I'd like you to write it down, those three things. And I said, Tom, I can remember 50 phone numbers. Why do I need to write it down? He said, I thought you wanted me to help you. I said, I do. He said, then please write it down. So I drank and used as long as I possibly could. That was about 35 years. Like a lot of people in here, like Tina, our 10-minute speaker, I started drinking at puberty. And that was probably about 12 or 13 to the best of my recollection, which is a long time ago. My father, I think I'm safe in saying, was probably an alcoholic. He was had a real good work ethic. He believed in, he had a lot of, lived by certain principles, which he tried to instill in us. I'm the oldest of six kids. Frankly, I didn't have a very good relationship with my father. But that's not what this story's about. You know, that's for another program, and it covers some of that stuff, too, in the family afterward. So he died, like a lot of alcoholics do, at a young age, relatively young, 56. He was a World War II vet with Purple Hearts, Bronze Star, other assorted medals. He always worked, and what happened was... he would have these jobs where he was managing or opening new supermarkets. and he would be the meat buyer for these chains of equivalent to a Bonds or a Ralph's or whatever. And then as time progressed, his earning power would go down, and he would be having lesser jobs, but still worked. And my mother was an RN who worked as an RN for 50 years. Her last 20 years, she worked in a methadone clinic and a treatment facility. I forget how many years in each, but and all the men in my family, to the best of my knowledge, are alcoholic and drug addicts. But that's not what why I'm an alcoholic. And what I used to really puzzle about, why am I an alcoholic? And if I learn a lot about it, I'll be able to curtail it. And I don't know if I ever really wanted to control my drinking. I wanted to drink as much as I wanted to drink until I was ready to stop drinking. And, you know, it seemed to be okay for about 20 years. And then the last 10 or 12 years were wasn't any fun at all, and it was really became a full-time job, you know. Because I'm a liter of vodka a day at the end. I prefer older scotch, you know, fine wines and all that stuff. But what it ends up with is plain wrap vodka in the largest bottle available, wine by the gallon, and, you know, that's what it, you know, brought me to at the end. And I didn't understand this stuff they talk about, you know, the phenomenon of craving, that once an alcoholic crosses a certain point, he cannot stop drinking. And you heard a little bit about that a few minutes ago. And congratulations to all the birthday people, too. That's awesome, man. So that's, you know, kind of the way it went. I mean, you know, like a lot of people, I started off drinking beer or whatever and then figured out, you know, if you buy hard alcohol, it goes a lot further. It's a lot easier to conceal. Plus, you seem a lot hipper at parties when you ask a young lady to have a drink instead of a can of beer, you know. But I don't know. Maybe I should, like, look in the book because I'm, like, starting to get a little bit lost. Which is kind of, I'm usually not speechless, but, and the other thing about, you know, being sober, getting sober when you're older, like I did, and staying sober a while is you kind of, things start breaking down like your eyes. So, you know, I got these nifty new glasses. So I make use of these. Okay, this is from the doctor's opinion. Don't worry, I'm not going to do a lot of reading, but I am going to reference a few places in the book. The doctor's opinion, this is definitely where I'm at. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. So I love the effect produced by alcohol. You know, it's like probably a lot of people in here, when, I won't say when I had my first drink, because I used to open beers for my dad when he was watching a ball game or whatever, he said, could you get me a beer? And I go, man, this stuff must be really something, because he, you know, drinks one after the other, you know. So I take a little sip. You know, not so much that he's going to notice it and, you know, give him the beer and so forth, you know. But I really don't remember my first drunk. But I remember one drunk in particular that we were low on funds and my little, they call it a gang nowadays, but back then I was just, you know, a bunch of guys that hung out. And we got a bottle of Ariba wine. I doubt they still make it, but it's probably equivalent to Mad Dog 2020 or something like that. And drank about half a bottle of that Ariba and was about the sickest I'd ever been to that point in my life. Of course, I'd only been alive 13 years, so, you know. But I was pretty damn sick, and I thought, I'll never drink that again. So when you read more about alcoholism, it kind of goes into that kind of stuff, you know, how we switch from one to the other. And I kind of hung out with older guys for the most part, except for a few schoolmates. And at that time, you weren't really allowed to hang out if you were did actions that were unseemly, or fighting was okay, but you know, you weren't allowed to stumble, slur your words, and that kind of stuff in public, you know. And so I kind of learned how to drink by these guys' example. Of course, I never saw them once they got home and continued drinking what they acted like then. But so I kind of had some guidelines, and I was a horrible student. I don't know if anybody can relate to that. I was always thinking about something. All right, I hand one up. Another one. I was always sitting there thinking about something, you know, and my teachers used to say I was a daydreamer. And I thought, well, you know, what's wrong with being a date, you know? What's wrong with having dreams, you know? And so if I didn't want to study something, I simply didn't study it, you know? And I would either fail it or get such a low grade that I would just barely squeak through. Also, I decided if I didn't want to go to school and there was something exciting going on down in a little wooded area where I grew up, such as being Tarzan for the day or Robinson Crusoe or one of my other heroes, I'd go down there. It was a little swimming hole, a little Tarzan rope and all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, I didn't know that, you know, obviously then, and I didn't know it for many years until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and discovered that's really alcoholic behavior before the alcohol was even introduced into my system. I went to a Catholic school, and they used to be real dogmatic about having a little white shirt with a little maroon tie with the school insignia on it, and having a neat haircut and all that sort of stuff. And remember once they told me to get a haircut and I didn't get one. So they gave me money to go down to the barbershop a couple blocks away. I just took a bus down to the little area where there were some movie theaters and went to the movies, you know. Basically, I would do whatever I wanted to do whenever I wanted to do it. And I didn't care what the consequences were. You know, I was willing to pay them. And so that accelerated as I got older and I started doing other things that were in that sort of vein. I had like, you know, a lot of opportunities like a lot of alcoholics do. Since I did so poorly in school, my grandfather thought I better, you know, help him with some direction. So he got me a job in a TV station at 16. And it was the job of my dreams, man. It's still, like, probably one of the best jobs I ever had. And, of course, I found the people that drank on Friday afternoon downstairs in the basement. You know, I would find, wherever I went, I would find somebody that was drinking, you know, or they were going to be drinking, and I wanted to get in on it. So, that behavior just kind of carried through and accelerated to other lengths as I got older. But I like to use this, my friend Larry's description of alcoholism. He says, when you first start out, it's fun. Then the second stage is fun with some trouble. And then the third stage is trouble. And so that's what happened to me. And it may have happened to you, I don't know. I was always like, had this idea like, if you wanted to do something, and I don't know where I got this, but my father didn't tell me to do this, but if you wanted to really do something, you should just do it. No matter how crazy or whatever it seemed. So I would do stuff like that. And I wanted to drive when I had this great job at the TV station, but my father wouldn't let me drive. So I always was into horses, and I used to spend all my money, which I had a job from the time I was 11 years old, a job of some kind, always. And I'd spend my money on going horseback riding. And so I bought a horse at 16. You know, and I met these guys that were in this riding club. And I'm from Maryland originally, but I've lived in OB like over 40 years. Except for brief periods in treatment centers, institutions, and other, you know, little side jaunts here and there. So I started doing this, and, you know, I met the people around the horses that I thought were the movers and shakers, and it was like this riding club called the Rosedale Rangers. And the head of the president of the club was a Baltimore City cop that was on a mounted police patrol. And we had, you know, we rode in parades and went out and did horse shows for veterans' homes and stuff like that. And we'd wear these hats. The uniform was a white hat with a turquoise shirt with white fringes on it, you know. And I forget if there was a pants or not, but see, some kind of pants, I forget. Well, after a while, I became aware of these other guys that were called the Hillcrest Riders. And the Hillcrest Riders had black hats with, you know, dark dressed and all dark clothing. Kind of like it is right now, like real hip to dress all in black. And I kind of gravitated over the Hillcrest Riders. And, you know, these guys carried whiskey in the saddlebag. You know, they had beer parties at the barn. And saying the Rosedale Rangers didn't do any of that, you know. So that's kind of how it went. And then I met some people on the racetrack. It seemed like a great idea to work with racehorses. So I did that. So I traveled, you know, between Florida and New York. And eventually came to California. That's how I came to California, actually. 20 racehorses on a railroad car. That's how I got to California. You know, that I loved it with that, working on the racetrack, because those guys were really heavy drinkers, you know. But, you know, they didn't drink on the job, at least that I'm aware of. It was like this older guys kind of thing, and you had to, like, maintain a certain kind of professional demeanor, so to speak, because you're taking care of horses that are worth maybe millions of dollars. But at night, you know, they would just go crazy. And so they introduced me to all the various nightlife in New York City and stuff like that. So sometimes they wouldn't want to go out, and I couldn't understand why they wouldn't want to go out. You know, everything's open, let's go, you know. And so I'd go by myself, and I'd have a great time, man. I mean, you know, I might end up in Harlem. I might end up in Spanish Harlem. I might end up down on Lower 14th Street. I mean, I didn't really care. If there was music playing and there were women there, I was on it, man. And that was all the fun of drinking, you know, all that kind of stuff. And there would be every once in a while you have, you know, a few mishaps, but they're just kind of like a pothole on the road, and you just keep going, you know. So, you know, I might get in some dangerous situation or something like that, but, you know. My father taught me how to box when I was 5 years old. So, not that I'm a really good boxer or anything, but I kind of know the stance, so they kind of, you know. But, so then I saw this movie, and it was, I think it was called Ride the Wild Surf in New York. And I saw these guys riding waves. I thought, that's what I want to do. So I got to go to California. So I came out to California. And the racetrack life here wasn't as good as back there, because they had, it wasn't union, but they had, like, you know, you worked 5.5 days a week, and you got, you know, percentage of the horse's earnings, you got paid really well, you had really nice living quarters, and out here it wasn't like that, you know. So I said, well, this doesn't seem compatible with surfing. So you know, I left that, and then I got this letter, and I called my mom up, because I was moving around, you know. She said, yeah, this letter came for you, and it said we can't forward it, so we gave me your address. I go, well, what is it? And she said, I think it's something from the government. And so what it was a draft notice. So I had what I call drinkus interruptus, because I had to go report to this, or I was supposed to go report to this, you know, thing for the service, and that was the beginning of the Vietnam deal. So I didn't want to do it, but, you know, I went and did it. And I got to say, you know, to any veterans in the room, I was not a good military person. You know, I was not, I don't like following rules, you know, like a lot of alcoholics. So I have utmost respect for those that did complete their service the way that it was supposed to be completed. So I started telling these people, I mean, I went to the Vietnam thing, but it was all safe because I'm on a ship and where they're shelling, you know. So, I mean, the only thing that's going to happen is, like, you fall down a ladder or somebody drops a shell on your head or something, you know. But it was some pretty righteous surfing out there and, like, giant waves. So that was a highlight, sort of my experience there. But I loved going to the ports, you know, when you weren't on duty, when you were in port and you could go ashore, they would call it. That was great, you know, because all these Filipino guys, I loved that the best in the Philippines. Man, they could play note-perfect rock and roll. It would sound just like the Beatles or the Kinks or the Rolling Stones or whoever. And I loved that, and I loved Filipino women as well. You know, so I had a lot of great adventures doing that. But when I came back to the States and they sent me to shipfitter school, I decided, you know, this isn't really what I had in mind. I did go to Vietnam. I was, you know, did the certain required amount of time, and now I'd like to go. And they said, well, you can't really do that. Why don't you go over and talk to the chaplain? And went over and talked to the chaplain, and he, you know, listened and then patted me on the head or whatever and said, you know, now you go ahead on back to duty, son. And that wasn't the kind of answer I was looking for. So I went to some of the officers, the XO on the ship, and I explained them my situation. You know, no, you don't understand, man. You know, I'm like, my grandmother was a graduate of Peabody School of Music. You know, I'm a living, breathing rock and roll demon. I'm not in those words exactly, but something like that. And they just said, you go back to duty. And so, you know, I started talking to guys, well, what do you do when you're in this situation? They said, well, what you do is you let them know you're serious, you know, and you just don't come back to work. I went on. So in the meantime, I met this girl on Mission Beach who became my future wife. I had a date with her, and they told me I had the duty, and I said, but I paid this other guy to stand my duty, which is standard procedure. And this guy said, well, you're not going. And I didn't say, fuck you. I just got dressed and left. So I got 17 hours AWOL equaled 3 days bread and water with all my hair cut off, which wasn't much hair to begin with. And so I kind of, that was my first major resentment besides my father that I can recall. So that's kind of like what it talks about in the book is resentment is the number one offender. It kills more alcoholics than anything else, you know. So I'm just trying to set the, you know, stage, and maybe I'm talking about this a little bit too much so I can fast forward, but I just wanted to, like, set the stage that all these behaviors I was exhibiting are characteristics of alcoholism. And, you know, so anyway, I ended up with the, they gave me 6 months in, I did a bunch of those AWOLs, you know, you got to do it more than once. So I, you know, did that numerous times, so they knew I was serious. And eventually the FBI came and arrested me in Hermosa Beach, or no, it was El Segundo. That's where I was living, surfing in Hermosa Beach. And so they gave me 6 months, and this prison was really bizarre. It was built during the Spanish-American War, apparently in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. And, you know, it was, I don't know, in a way, it was like really a turning point in my life. Because, you know, I asked for a solitary cell because I didn't want to, you know, be bunking with a bunch of other people and guys in the same room. So they gave me that. And on one side was a murderer, and on the other side was an embezzler. So I was like in excellent company. And so I did a lot of reading, and I figured out my plan. When I get out, I'm going to school. I'm going to get a job bartending. I'll be able to set up the deal on, you know, with music. And, of course, I'm married. So when I got out, that's what I did, you know. And I had some really interesting bartending jobs. At the time, I was not, I think, I was alcoholic, but I was not malfunctioning. You know, I was still a functioning alcoholic. And I didn't drink all the time. Like, I was surfing, going to college, attending bar and stuff. And that seemed to go along pretty good. And I remember serving this president of an insurance company, vodka on the rocks, and he would come in, and he actually ended up getting a room at the hotel. It was a Grand Hotel downtown. He got a room there so he could drink like he wanted to. So I thought, Jesus, man, how can somebody drink that vodka on the rocks? Remember one night he had like 17 of them. And then the waiters would carry him up to the room. Well, 3 years later, I'm in Bob's Hollywood Bar, you know, doing this music thing, and finally made some headway in the music thing, and I get this little record and put this little record out, and, you know, got a little place and had left my family, and I'm like in this Bob's Hollywood Bar on Christmas Day, and I'm all alone, and I'm like crying, you know. And I would see guys do that when I was tending bar, and I thought, Jesus, man, hold yourself together, you know. Go home and do that, you know. And I was calling up, you know, my family long distance in those little wooden phone booths I used to have in a bars. And so that was really the pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization, except I didn't know that's what it was. And I was willing to pay the price to have whatever success I could achieve in the music thing, you know. And that included deserting my family, being unemployable, except for playing music. And I thought this is the only way you're ever going to do it, you know. And by then, my drinking had really accelerated. There was a couple different points when my drinking accelerated, and that was one of them. And I remember a drummer saying to me once, man, can't you just, like, drink a little bit less? You know? I'd say, Wally, why would I want to drink any less? And he quit the band shortly thereafter. But, you know, during this time, and this was in the, I mean, I did lots of different kinds of music, but this was the punk rock era. And I'd been a punk rocker for years and just, you know, was getting thrown out of places and stuff like that, you know, banging my heads on the cymbals and stuff like this, you know, just, and I just thought that's what you're supposed to be doing, you know, if you're having fun. And these guys came by once and they said, hey, we're going down to the Plasma Center. I said, what's that? And the Plasma Center, in case no one understands what that is, that's where they draw your blood out. They take 1 pint of blood, and then they pump it through this system, recirculate back a certain amount of plasma into you, and then it takes, like, a certain amount of time for that to rebuild the whole blood. So for a lark, I went down to this place to understand, because I'm an artist, so I got to have this experience to understand what it's about. And somebody happened to have some LSD, so I took that. And they said, wait till you get the physical first, and then you take the acid. I went, oh, okay. So I got the physical, and they okayed me, and I got up, you know, then I went to the bathroom, dropped the acid. And then as the blood was pumping out, you know, I'm coming onto this acid, and it was pretty intense. And I was, you know, they almost stopped the procedure because I was like, I guess I was like cold sweating or whatever. And but I said, no, I'm okay, you know. And so that was a joke when I first did it, but wasn't that much longer that whenever I was out of money, which was frequently, I was down to the plasma center, and at one point I was like the frequent, I don't know, they had, I forget the name for it, but a guy that was able to come in and do so many times during the month, you got like this little card with like an extra $5 or $10 or something. And if you go and do that, which is what I did, and then immediately go to the liquor store, at that time, I knew how much a half pint of pop-up was within a 15-mile area at every single liquor store, and what time they opened and what time they closed. Going to get a pint of pop, a half pint of pop-off, $1.09, and you got one-eighth of your blood supply has been donated, and you do that straight down, that is a rush. And, you know, that was how my drinking accelerated. And I used to read about drugs, too. Drugs is part of my story, but alcohol is my drug of choice. So when I say alcoholic, that covers all of it. And I tried just about everything out there except for crack. Crack wasn't invented yet. You know, so I was real discriminating. I'd read about these different drugs, you know, what they did, what the effects were. And it used to seem to be like a great tool, you know, for certain drugs, for and alcohol always, for writing a song. Certain drugs and alcohol always for great sex. Certain drugs and alcohol for going to sleep. And so that's how I started using, you know. And then I was at a party, this is where we fast forward a bit, after the plasma center era, and I'm at some party, and there was a thing of pills sitting on this table. And for some reason, all the people left the living room. I'm looking around, you know, hey. So I grabbed this bottle, discreetly put it in my pocket, and I take one. And I can't notice any great effect, except my fingers and my toes are kind of starting to feel like a little weird. And I went, oh. So I went home, and actually, I was living in this place where the guy was one of our music supporters, had actually said I could live there if I painted his house, the interior only, three rooms in this house over Mission Hills. So I think I was living there about a month and a half. I'm not a quick painter. But I had this drug, and I took them back, and, you know, took a couple of them, and my hands started going like this. And my toes were like, my feet were doing the same thing, and it was, like, kind of painful. And I thought, man, what is this stuff? And I went to the emergency room, and it turned out it was some stuff called Prolixin, which is for people that have a psychotic disorder. So that's kind of where my drug use, you know, and alcohol took me, is to stuff like that, doing stuff like that. And, you know, usually I was arrested for either DUI, which I had, you know, four or five that I was caught for, or drunk in public, or I think once it was, the original charge was inciting a riot at a punk rock club downtown called the Skeleton Club. But they dropped that charge. And then shoplifting, I got busted once. I discovered, man, you know, I've been shopping this Mayfair Market and bought food for my kids and my family for years. They owe me a couple bottles of scotch. You know what I mean? I mean, that's kind of like alcoholic reasoning. Basically, what happens with alcohol as the disease progresses is it's what's called delusional thinking, and it talks about that in the book. you know, cannot differentiate the true from the false. So one of those escapades, I got busted at Mayfair Market. Of course, they took me to jail, and kind of embarrassing. And I had a girl waiting out in the car. I said, so I'll be right back. You know? And I've been drinking all day. I mean, I consumed who knows how much alcohol. But, you know, you can never have enough, you know. So at that time, there was a race riot going on in there. And some gang members said, don't hit that buzzer, because some guy started having a heart attack. And they said, don't hit, anybody hits that buzzer, they're going to die. And so the race riot was going on, and I was like all sick and, you know, detoxing. I mean, I don't know how I could detox all that alcohol on me, but, you know, it just became, and those started, things started to happen like on a, you know, on a regular basis. And so about 1982, I'd been homeless for 3 days, living in a broken down car, drinking hot vodka, and living on popcorn. I got, you know, the movie theaters, when they close, if it's a slow night, they put out all the popcorn. And so I got this big bag of popcorn. You know, it was like a big hefty bag. Carried that back to the car. So, you know, I mean, that's how, what it brought me to, man. So I'm unemployable. I'm homeless. I'm like so incredibly embarrassed and ashamed, you know. And I would not hang out with any other homeless people. Because I'm not, this is only temporarily for me, man. So that was the beginning of my recovery. I went into the VA hospital in 1982. And, you know, after about 2 weeks, your body starts regenerating. Unless you got major liver damage or other organ damage. And I didn't have that at that time. So after about 2 weeks, I'm going, man, you know, I'm good, you know. And so what I got from that was another 4 years of misery. More of that same kind of stuff I'm talking about. Just like I hit some girl in the face in a blackout at the Whiskey A Go-Go in Hollywood that was a friend of mine. I have no idea why. I have no, even some kind of a weird blackout. Maybe I was trying to punch somebody else and her face moved in a way. I don't know. But somebody knocked me down and stomped on my hand. And so I still got this, like, weird little crooked finger from that incident, which isn't much compared to what some people have gotten in here. But, I mean, you know, that's the kind of stuff, I mean, that stuff was just happening. I was going to the emergency room, you know, I'm just thinking, man, it can't get any worse. And then I was up climbing on Mount Helix one day after drinking massive amounts of alcohol, and I fell off the top of this boulder and crushed a couple vertebrae, and I thought, man, it's really, I was looking at the lights at Tijuana, right? It's really awesome. And then the next thing I knew, I was like going through the air, and I blamed it on the tread on my combat boots was worn down, and that's why I slipped. I was drunk, that's why it happened. So I spent 10 days, first I walked around for 3 days, taking every painkiller that I could find, drinking massive amounts, and then I went to the hospital, and they said, we got two crushed vertebrae. So I was in there for 10 days. Again, it was all just like, don't worry, it'll be fine. You know, girls coming in, bringing in vodka. You know, I mean, I always was doing that, you know, manipulating other people to get what I wanted, what I needed. And as a lot of you probably know, they're out there, man, you know. I think they're called codependents. They'll fix you. There's always a woman or a man that will fix you if you find the right one. And then I had like a really expensive guitar, so that would go in and out of the pawn shop because I could always get a quick 100, and then I'd get some girl to buy it out for me, and then, you know, it would be back in the pawn shop. It just was total insanity, and, you know, about 4 years, and I had this, the broken back. They ended up putting a torso cast, so I wore a torso cast for 6 months, and, you know, the pain was like, you know, so I was like, you know, now I was like really, you know, just drinking around the clock, man, and drink and eating as much pain meds as I could get. And, you know, that's the way my life was going. I mean, it was just like, how could this get any worse? And then something else would happen. So I went to another, you know, couple treatment centers, and I started trying to apply what's in this book, you know. But I did it like half measures. And in How It Works, it says half measures avail us nothing. So that's what I got, was I didn't get half measures. I got nothing. And I kept relapsing again and again and again, you know. And then I met that guy, Tom P., at that morning meeting. And that's when I had the sobriety date that I had today, 3/25/95. And I got active with Tom, and he lived a couple blocks from me. And so I'd meet with him once a week at least, once a week for the steps and reading. I firmly believe in reading the literature. Don't take my word for what's in the book or somebody else's. Read it yourself. Aldous Huxley, a great writer, called it a blueprint for living. And that's, you know, that's what it is. And there's one other little part in this book. How are we doing on time? 2 minutes? Okay. This is repeated over and over, and unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there is very little hope for his recovery. So what I finally did was surrendered, man. You know, I surrendered, and what happened was I started getting a quality of life back. I became employable. I worked for the same company for 10 years, was one of their top producers. Now work in a totally different field. Been there 3.5 years. I'm a valued employee there. I don't make a lot of money, but I make enough to pay my bills. I reunited with my family, so I'm going up to Washington State in February for my oldest daughter's first child. I have two children by my youngest daughter. And today we went to the Y and went swimming. And so, you know, that's kind of the way my life is today, man. It's like, you know, it's problems of abundance, you know. I mean, no matter what goes wrong, it doesn't really matter as long as sobriety is my number one priority. And so, you know, that's really how I live. And so I try and live by these principles. I fall short most of the time. But sobriety is my daily priority. I used to have a problem with God. I no longer have that problem. They said all I need to know about God is I'm not him. And I asked God to guide my words tonight, you know, so that I can be of service to somebody in this room. And I hope somebody did gain something from this. If at the very least, you stayed sober for the time that this meeting was going on. And this is where the hope is, man. So if you want what we have and you're willing to go to any lengths to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. Once you take the steps, like somebody else outlined, that's when your life changes, you know. And I still have a few financial amends, but I am, you know, I have done most of my amends. I don't know, man. It's a great life. It's the best deal in town. You know, I can't imagine my life being any better. You know, and it's all due to Alcoholics Anonymous and people that have kept coming back. Not to diminish anybody else's sobriety, but in particular Jerry for 35 years. And I never knew his name, but I've seen him at a lot of meetings over, you know, the past 15, 20 years in San Diego. So I want to thank you very much for being here tonight. You've helped me in my sobriety. Thank you.